I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This time, again, we're in Professor James Dedarian's global security classroom at Brown with the War Stories columnist at Slate, the online magazine, Fred Kaplan. Fred Kaplan's new book is titled Daydream Believers, an allusion to Lawrence of Arabia, which we will ask him to unfold. The book is about bad ideas, a few grand ideas that wrecked American power, his subtitle says. Ideas about weaponry and real influence, ideas about the U.S. in history, about the U.S. in the world, ideas about solo acts and allied solidarity in a time now of inescapable global crisis. On your mark, everybody, for an open conversation here. First, we're going to ask Fred Kaplan for his account of the ideas that got us to wherever it is we're at. Fred.
Oh, thank you. I guess, you know, President Obama says to understand how to get out of a mess, we first have to know how we got into it. So the obvious way that we got into the mess in foreign policy is that the last 8 years have been drenched in terrible policies. The whole notion, which is now being reversed, of simply not even talking with a country if we don't regard it as quite legitimate, of breaking off negotiations that were going well and letting just all hell fall apart. But there's something more structural, too, and that's what I want to back up and present this whole thing in a framework. It wasn't just the bad ideas. It was bad ideas at a particularly bad time, and the nature of that bad time made the bad ideas even worse. And that is, the Bush administration came into power thinking that we had emerged from our Cold War victory stronger than we were before. Not just stronger, but hyper-strong. The phrase was tossed around that we are the sole superpower. The idea that basically we could do whatever we wanted. We could topple regimes at will. We could follow those treaties that we liked, but just ignore those that we didn't. A few bombs set off in a key place would make the rest of our foes tremble and acquiesce to our desires. And, you know, that we could basically rule the world like Rome. There were people, Richard Perle even talked about how we are the new Rome. But this was a fallacy. What really happened, I would contend that we emerged from the end of the Cold War, even in victory, weaker than we were. So we get into power. I mean, the Bush people get into power. They think that they're super, not just superpower, but hyperpowers, when in fact they're weaker. If you're weaker and you act like you're all powerful, then you're going to do things that make you weaker still. I remember there was a conference, a Southeast Asian or an Asian economic conference that Bush went to shortly after September 11th. Bush gets up and the entire speech was terrorism, 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 terrorism. You're either with us or against us. You're with us or against us. The Chinese president gets up. He says, I want to trade with everybody. Come have trade agreements with us. Come have most favored nation status. Let us talk about expanding trade. Everybody comes up to President Hu after his speech. Nobody comes up to President Bush after his speech. The point is that he had become locked into this notion that not only did we rule everything, but that we set the terms under which power was defined. So that's Obama comes along, he says, we're going to restore our alliances, we're going to start talking with people about the things they care about. We understand that there are these problems, we can't do it all ourselves, we're going to work with other countries. But and this is all to the good. I mean, this is very good, and it will have productive consequences. But there is a problem, and that is, you know, sometimes we have trouble dealing with countries, other countries, not just because, you know, we're not talking to each other. Maybe we understand each other quite well, and we just don't agree with each other. We have very different, even colliding interests. So to restore, it's not going to be, okay, it's 1999 all over again. Let's just go back to where it was. We're not in that world anymore. This world doesn't exist. The world didn't change after September 11th, but it did change after, you know, November 1991. It did when the Soviet Union fell apart. You don't even have a multipolar world. You have what you could call a polypolar world, where there are some countries are dominant in one realm but not in another. Other countries are dominant in some different realm, but there's no system tying it together. There is no – the whole notion of a superpower is an absurd concept. It's impossible to have one. So the challenge that Obama has is how to re-engage the United States in the world and restore some of our power and influence, but in a world that is not all that keen to go along with us in many things that we want to do, and where if we do form alliances, we are going to have to be making as many compromises as the other country is. And in certain parts of the world, especially the Middle East, this is going to impinge not only on multiple interests of multiple states, but our own domestic politics as well. So it's not just a question of we're back, we're nice again, come join us. There are real issues dividing countries. There are very few, many fewer instruments of international politics to make these cohesive in any way. And that's the world that he's having to face and having to gain some influence in again.
Fred Kaplan, could I just say, for me, part of the reward of this book is the reminder that ideas, bad ideas too, have a history and a mm-hmm. paper trail. You go back 50 years, especially through the remarkable Andrew Marshall at the Pentagon and the Rand Corporation to the sort of the seedbed of the neocon premises. Would you give us a short course on how we these ideas before we heard them? I mean, I think we as citizens improvise our understanding of what our policymakers are doing, but the policymakers are in fact working off a plan,
right,
and a lot of carefully planned, awfully often very badly thought out premises. But what were
well,
they?
Well, the assumption of going into Iraq, let's use that as the going in point. The idea was this was going to be easy, because we have these new instruments of warfare. It was called the Revolution in Military Affairs. These new bombs are popularly called smart bombs, where the munitions were so accurate that it could destroy. You know, you remember the footage from the 91 war. Well, maybe not. I don't know. But footage of, a bomb just going through a chimney of a building and blowing up the building and nothing around it. Just precision warfare combined with light army forces that could move very, very quickly, the two together, the war will be over before you know it, and with, only 130,000 troops being used, whereas, in 1991 there were 500,000 troops on the border between Kuwait and Iraq to push the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. Now we are going to have 150,000 troops and smart bombs conquer Baghdad, and it's pretty amazing. And the even more amazing part of it is that part of it worked. This incredibly speedy rush up the Euphrates to Baghdad, just blowing up resistance whenever we met them, and really conquering Baghdad. But the problem was that in this vision, and I could go back over the history of how it happened, but I think it's more important right now to make the main point. This is a very apolitical view of war. Clausewitz defined war as politics by other means. What that meant was that wars are fought for political objectives, and they're not over, much less won, until those political objectives have been accomplished. So it's not just that, you overthrow Saddam Hussein. That's step one. Step two is, in fact, much harder, and that is bringing order to Iraq. Bush and so forth talked about a democratic order, but if not that, some stable order that you don't have to stick around for the next decade or two. That part of it was just ignored for two reasons, for two completely different reasons that happened to converge. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, wanted – this is oversimplifying. This is simplifying a little bit, but not oversimplifying. Wanted the Iraq War to serve as a model war, not only for us, but for all the foes out there. The idea was, look what we can do with basically one arm tied behind our back. Look at what we can do with 130,000 troops and some smart bombs. And we've done it to Saddam Hussein. We can do it to you next week and to you the week after. This should be a lesson to you. George Bush had this notion, which I think he really believed, that the idea of spreading democracy. Remember, he said, freedom is a gift from God, which if you believe that, it actually has some very profound implications. It suggests that freedom is the default mode of humanity and that in areas where there's not freedom, it's because there's a dictator who is stomping on his people, and that if you blow up the manhole cover, if you blow the lid of this tyrant off of the country, then freedom will burst forth and flow like the lava of a volcano. He thought you didn't have to do much post-war because you wouldn't have to. This, you know, it's freedom now, right? And especially once the elections happen, well, then that's really freedom. Ignoring that, you know, the first election in Iraq, you basically had Sunnis voting for religious Sunni parties, Shias voting for religious Shia parties, and Kurds basically voting to secede. So all that the elections did was to harden and politicize the social tensions that had been suppressed for decades and that became even more amplified and turned into, at least for a couple of years, a real civil war.
Fred Kaplan, would you take a shot at guessing what's the moral equivalent of the paper trail behind the Obama presidency? 5 years, 10 years, 100 years from now, what will we look back and discover were the operating premises, good or bad, that guided Barack Obama through the same thicket?
Well, I think going into the Bush administration, there really were a couple of ideological documents you can look back on. At the beginning of the Bush presidency, it wasn't clear at all that he was going to adopt them. I mean, at the beginning, remember his debate with Al Gore, he talked about how America should present itself to the rest of the world as a humble but strong power. If we were too arrogant, people would get angry at us. We should be strong but also humble. Condoleezza Rice at the beginning, who was his main foreign policy advisor, was essentially a realist. She was talking about going back to big power politics, dealing with the major powers. These countries like Iraq and North Korea, they were going to – time wasn't on their side. Classic theories of deterrence will take care of them if they get big weapons. That changed after September 11th, and then these documents that have been floating around about – you know, American preeminence through these weapons that can – these wonder weapons, those became the operative documents. The interesting thing I'm finding about Obama, and again, it's too early to tell definitively, but he seems to be reverting back to a more traditional American pragmatism. I don't think there will be an Obama ideology. I don't think there will be a defining doctrine, you know, a 10-point doctrine. His views, I think, are, you know, flexibility, pursuit of national interests, recognition that we can't do everything by ourselves and that therefore we need alliances, including sometimes with alliances with leaders that aren't terribly appetizing to do business with. You see him trying to do a deal with Russia. You know, we'll forget about this missile defense in Eastern Europe, which he never really had much faith in to begin with, and faith is the operative word there. But, you know, in exchange for you guys helping us out with keeping Iran from going nuclear, or at least from not selling them surface-to-air missiles to give them greater confidence in doing what they seem to be doing. You're going to have to be cutting deals with Syria to break them loose from Iran. This might involve pressuring Israel on the Golan Heights, which is going to lead to problems not only with Israel but perhaps with certain American domestic politics as well. In other words, I think what it is fundamentally in a sentence, it's a recognition of the world as a complicated place, far more complicated than – you know, the Cold War was really sort of the frozen moment in history. Something like that, this 50-year period of two stable powers, you know, kind of this titanic struggle with practically – with most of the world aligned with one or the other of them, that was freezing history. There had been nothing like this in the millennia before. What's going on now, it wasn't – you know, for a while there was this school that the end of the Cold War was the end of history. Actually, it's the resumption of history. And it's a resumption of a very unstable history. It's not even like, you know, the Congress of Vienna in part of the 19th century when there were five major powers and they figured out a stable balance of power. We're not at that point yet. It's a very – it's not quite anarchy, but it's a very it's a situation without a point of equilibrium. I think he understands that. I think the people that he has on the top levels understand that. Where it's going, the problem of it is that it's where it goes is it's not entirely in our own control now. Even in Iraq, you know, right now, even if John McCain had been elected president, he might have to pull out of Iraq at the end of 2011 because there's something called a status of forces agreement where unless the Iraqi government changes its mind, they're demanding. Part of the agreement is, yeah, you can do this and you can do that and you can do that. But by the end of 2011, all U.S. forces have to be out. They're determining that. We're not determining that anymore. We haven't been in control of what's going on in Iraq politically for quite some time. So it is. I think he understands that it is a world – he can't say this explicitly. It is a world in which America does not have the power that it once had. And we are going to have to navigate these shoals much more delicately and draw on many more countries to help us do this, including countries that you know, are allies of convenience in this realm only.
I have one more question about the bad ideas that took us into Iraq. It just reminds me of a moment that probably not everybody in this room remembers. 1970, Vietnam time, people that, again, are unfamiliar to you, but Jimmy Breslin was kind of the world's greatest newspaper columnist at the time. There were the peacenik priests, Daniel Berrigan and Philip Berrigan, who were in and out of prison for war resistance. And, of course, there were the patrician Cold Warriors, McGeorge Bundy and Bill Bundy, deep in the policy. But Jimmy Breslin made the remark at Harvard in 1970. I just will never forget it. He said, I'll tell you what's wrong with the world. He said, the Berrigan brothers are in jail and the Bundy brothers are on the street. There was never, even after the Vietnam War, there was never a kind of formal correction and sort of public hangings for a disastrous policy. Where are we in the reckoning of the sinners around Iraq? I mean, will they ever be held accountable? Will they ever be fired from all their public and private positions?
You know, there are a lot of countries that Dick Cheney can't go traveling in anymore.
Good ones too, right?
Yeah. Then again, he has never been terribly disposed to go traveling in other countries in any case. So I guess it doesn't put a crimp in his lifestyle. But I don't know if there's going to be a reckoning. I think there is one already. I mean, I don't think Donald – I'd be very surprised if Donald Rumsfeld's memoirs sell a lot of copies. I hear that he was having a hard time finding a commercial publisher to pay him the advance that he wanted for it. I don't think there are going to be a lot of boards that want these people on him. But, you know, let's not get carried away with Obama. Obama fundamentally is not a revolutionary either. And I think he is so concerned, maybe and sometimes overly concerned, with maintaining some kind of – at least the patina of nonpartisanship in getting his legislative agenda passed. I don't think he's going to be wanting to whip up the passions of a crusade against the sinners of the past. I think his inclination is more to just move on with it. Now, obviously, there will be hearings in Congress. There may even be Justice Department investigations. But I don't see a White House-led, truth commission being set up. I think it would interfere too much with, you know, he has so many things to accomplish legislatively without even getting involved in foreign affairs at all. That I don't think he's going to want to be whipping things up in that way.
This is just the batting practice. The real game begins when James Derderian poses a deep question.
We like our history sliced up into neat little binaries, good guys, bad guys. And your book is a corrective. It shows that you can't lay this all on the door of the Bush administration, which is why we can't draw and quarter all the neocons, because you'd have to extend it to a much larger group of
We're not just the neocons.
Yes. Decision makers and people deep in the bowels of the Pentagon, like Andrew Marshall, who is the director of the net assessment, who we never hear about, but actually has a long legacy in this. But I was wondering if the road to Baghdad, you know, led through Grenada and Panama, through Kosovo and Bosnia, you know, other, you know, humanitarian interventions that even Democrats could get behind. Did that sort of lower the threshold for using high technology, low lethality as a way to solve these intractable sort of political problems?
Well, it did in the sense that I remember when I was a Pentagon reporter in the 1980s, when the buildup to the first Gulf War of 1990 to 1991, one question that a lot of people, and I don't mean just you know hellraisers, but even serious military officers were wondering is, can we do this? I mean, do we know how to do this? Can we fight a war? I mean, Vietnam was such a rout and such a demoralizing rout. The idea was, you know, my God, you know, our weapons don't work. Our officers can't lead. Can we really even fight a war anymore? Are we just going to get clobbered? Is this just going to be – and there were all these, you know, threat assessments about the mighty – you know, war-tested Iraqi army, which had fought against the Iranians for 8 years. Well, you know, we didn't know it at the time, but they were war exhausted. They were, you know, they practically surrendered. You know, there were times in 1991 they wanted to surrender to an airplane, you know, to surrender to five American soldiers. And then the bombing campaign, they were just exhausted. But what those smaller operations that you mentioned did to some degree was to help build back the confidence of at least small unit cohesions that, yes, a military operation, you can plan it, you can carry it out, and what do you know, it can be done. Now, some of them were pretty trivial, I mean, Grenada in particular. But I think that was the effect. They were mini laboratories of things that we did on a much larger scale later. I don't think anything led inexorably to that. In fact, you know, the typical military officer and someone like Colin Powell is typical of this. I mean, people would be surprised. Most military officers really don't want to fight wars. And remember Powell, who came out of Vietnam, he had, you know, what's called the Powell Doctrine. You know, you shouldn't get involved in a war at all unless you were going to do overwhelming force. I mean, that's why he insisted on 500,000 troops, you know, on the Iraqi-Kuwaiti border. Even so, Powell was against, you know, there was something called Desert Shield where you have the troops out in Kuwait, I mean, out in Saudi Arabia, right on the Kuwaiti border, to deter the Iraqis from going further into Saudi Arabia. And then you had Desert Storm, which was the invasion into Kuwait. Powell would have been satisfied with maintaining Desert Shield for months, even years. He was not interested. And then it was going to be originally a 10-day bombing campaign followed by the invasion. He got it. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time. He got extended to 30 days. He was there was no great eagerness among the officer corps for you know, looking at these other incursions and saying, "Yes, let's go get them." They have Vietnam in particular left them with too great a fear of quagmire and defeat to get bogged down in
not something. Just military. Even Dick Cheney didn't want to, you know,
time,
go
he,
all
he
the way
didn't
to Baghdad.
He didn't want to go to Baghdad, yeah. Because then you would have to keep troops there for a long time, and that's no good. That's what he said in 1991. Things changed. But yeah, there was still a much – there wasn't a lot of exuberance. And I think what's happened with Iraq and who knows how deeply we'll go into Afghanistan. But again, there was first the exhilaration of, wow, look what we can do with just a handful of troops and these smart bombs. But then the realization that, oh, that's just the beginning. So I don't think there's – much exhilaration to keep doing this sort of thing over and over, and certainly, you know, there's no draft. Here's the thing about Afghanistan, the relationship between Afghanistan and Iraq. For every new brigade that we put into Afghanistan, we have to take one out of Iraq because there are no other brigades anyplace. Hmm. I mean, here's, you know, the United States of America, big power, can barely service two small wars at the same time. In fact, can't. So that's the really limiting source here is that the army is afraid of getting, you know, thinned to the bone. So I don't see this as I don't think we're going to be doing a new round of you know, exuberant warfare around the world.
Let me take a stab at that deep question that Chris has put upon me. And that is the difference between the dreamers of the day and dreamers of the night that Lawrence of Arabia identifies. And what they have in common, I think, is to some extent both have in common, is an understanding of tragedy. On one hand, you can go out with great intentions, the dreamers of the day.
Forgive me, would you just read that quote because our
I did at the opening, but you want me to do it?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is one more time. T.E. Lawrence, all men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible. So that's dreamers of the day, dreamers mm-hmm. of the night.
Hence, daydream believers, essentially.
You're right. Great title. Great monkey song, too,
monkey
wasn't
song
it?
Monkey song, too, yeah. Yes.
None of these people know who the monkeys
no,
are.
No, I bet you do.
Never heard
right?
of the Bundy Brothers, but they know the monkeys.
No, right, it's right. on Nickelodeon. You probably watched it on Nickelodeon as kids. Right.
So the aspect of tragedy in this, that you can have this dream and things can go wrong, accidents, unintended consequences. But there's another element of things going wrong, and that's sort of almost the hubris that you identify that the Greeks were all too familiar with. And I'm thinking about Oedipus, where he knew he was going to end up, you know, sleeping with his mother and killing his father. So he took all these actions to avoid the fated outcome. And yet, because of the hubris, the arrogance that you think you control your own fate, you end up with this terrible tragedy. Does this link together those who try to do good and those who perhaps have other worse intentions, that there's something else working whenever you try to believe that you can control this polar...
But I think the dreamers of the night, I mean, that's everybody. It's like we all have wild dreams at night and we wake and we say, oh, well, that I'm not going to go do that. But the dreamers of the day, they actually think that they can accomplish these things. I also put it at one point in the book, I say it's one thing to be a visionary, it's another to have visions. You know, you can have ideals, you can work toward them, but you know, if you're walking a path and you come across a river, you can't just pretend the river doesn't exist. You have to either stop or find some way around it or build a boat or something. You can't just walk across the water. And the people who are leading our country the last 8 years, at least for the first 6 years of that, thought that they could walk across the water.
But my point is also, I mean, you speak of a polypolar world. I prefer heteropolar, but we can quibble about
whatever.
That.
Whatever. I haven't put a copyright on it.
Let me put it another way that Edmund Burke talks about, you know, all empires eventually fall to the empire of circumstance. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you believe that you can take your way of life and right. export it, the empire of circumstance is going to trump all those intentions, good intentions, mm-hmm. or bad. You know, we want to do it for oil. We want to do it for improving the democracy of the world, freedom of peoples, for humanitarian reasons.
Right. I think that, yeah, I think, I mean, there is a tendency in American history and culture generally, I think, that is not so keen on understanding foreign cultures. There's this notion that most people really kind of want to be just like us, don't they? And if it weren't for this, that, or the other thing, or if they really got to know us, you know, then they would really like us and you know, they too would like our new widescreen television and our movies and whatever. But in fact, you know, that's just not the case. But it's again, it goes back to Bush's thing about about freedom as a gift from God. It's this kind of universal state that the United States is living and that others can only dream about, but they would like to. And so they would welcome our intervention into this. And I think but I don't think there's anything inevitable about this. And I think one thing that's interesting about someone like Obama is his background. I mean, if you haven't read his memoir, Dreams from My Father, I really recommend it because it's really a good book by any measure. But it also gives a pretty deep understanding of where he's coming from. He wrote it when he was about 30. I don't think he was actively thinking of running for president at the time. But, you know, here's a man who straddled race, culture, who spent some of his youth in Hawaii, Indonesia, you know, with the father from Kenya. I mean, it's almost you couldn't make this up in any this idea of a multi-culti person, of someone who is now entering the presidency when the world is unavoidably cosmopolitan and hetero, whatever. And here is somebody who embodies that. Here is somebody who is from everywhere and nowhere, who I think has a grasp of this, and not a school-trained grasp, although there's that too. I think he studied international relations at Columbia, but a native grasp. It's in his DNA. And so I think, again, I mean, he has – you know, more on his plate than any president I think ever. It's too bad that I mean, not just you talk about being dominated by circumstance. I mean, the banking crisis alone could undo his whole administration, much less anything else going on in the world. But if he does get a chance to try to sway the world in one way or another, he comes at it from as sympathetic a position as any president in history, I think. From as unparochial a stance as anyone.
Open it up there,
please.
Okay, just some comments or reactions to what you've said.
Thank you. Should we know who you are, sir?
A brown dad. First of all, I think when George Bush came to office, as you indicated, I don't think he had this neocon vision.
No, he didn't.
And he was somebody who had not much experience in foreign policy. And I think what happened in Iraq was clearly a reaction to 9/11. And I think what this man was not well served by a foreign policy team that was a dream team. When you look at their credentials of Cheney, who had refused to go to WSSEC defense and refused to go to Baghdad, or part of the decision not to go. Powell, you talked about his credentials, et cetera. I think the problems or the dreams, if you will, or the focus that they had that was the same problem in Vietnam. And I'm going to pull this very quickly to Obama and ask you a question. But in Vietnam, I think we really didn't understand the culture. We didn't understand the country. We didn't understand the real political relationship between China and Vietnam and the effect it would have on the region. I think in Iraq, we didn't understand the Sunni-Shia split, the need for an Iraqi army, the need for, as you said, more troops to protect weapons and borders, the role Iraq played in the power struggle with Iran, if we were to go in at all. Now let's go to Afghanistan. And I think Obama is in danger, as smart, as analytical, with the background you indicated. He's in danger, perhaps, of making the same kind of mistake that was made in Vietnam and Iraq, because to this day, I don't understand what the mission is in Afghanistan.
No, I agree on the Afghanistan part. It's one of my big worries as well. As you mentioned, there is a strategic review going on now. In fact, there were three strategic reviews, one by the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, one by Central Command, Petraeus, and one in the White House. I'm told the one in the White House is the only one that really counts. And in fact, one part of that review is a review of the other reviews.
And who's in on that?
I mean, it's Obama, it's Jones, it's all of his advisors. But I mean, but the point is, here's – I think when you think about Obama and his team, the dominant player is Obama. And I've noticed, you know, he talks about limited goals in Afghanistan. I'm told that one thing that he has been disturbed about in Afghanistan to date, and not just him, is that you're right. What is the strategy? What is our goal here? What? How do we know when we've succeeded? What does that mean? What is the threat? How do you deal with it? Even among people who are the big advocates of counterinsurgency, there are still questions. Well, what do you do? Do you focus your forces on protecting the population? Well, which population? Or chasing terrorists? Where? You know. And I think there's also an understanding, not only by Obama, but among the people who are around him, that this is fundamentally a regional problem and that the real threat now is what's going on inside Pakistan, compared with which Afghanistan is a sideshow. And what you need in Pakistan, obviously we can't go doing much militarily in there. There's even a lot of reaction being riled up against just some of the drone bombs launched on al-Qaeda targets that happened to kill some people too. I mean, for every five terrorists that we're killing, you know, we're creating 50 or 100 new, if not terrorists and terrorist sympathizers who are pissed off that we killed their cousin or something like that. I mean, it's very dangerous. Obama, when he the other day made the decision to send an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan, he made clear that this did not predetermine the shape of his strategic review. This, I've talked with even some skeptics of Afghanistan who figured you had to do this now to shore up security before the elections. You had to be able – some operations that are going on now, if you want to rely less on air power and therefore bombing civilians inevitably, if unintentionally, then you need more ground troops in certain areas. And it does not determine – you know, it's not a slippery slope yet, but I think what I was getting around to is there's this view that it's a regional problem and that the real problem is in Pakistan, and to deal with Pakistan you're going to have to do a regional solution that involves somewhat settling the India-Pakistan crisis over Kashmir, because the Pakistani army is positioned mainly along the border with India, and therefore they're not going to divert very many troops to the northwest frontiers to deal with the anarchic areas where the Taliban are running free there. They're just not going to. So you have to have that situation settled. This will have to involve participation, active participation by Chinese, who have very strong influence in the area, Russia, Iran. I mean, it's one of these, you know, like remember when Iraq people said, well, you can't solve one problem without solving all of them? This is absolutely true in Pakistan. And once the scope of this problem, where you have, you know, a major country with nuclear weapons that faces deep instability and turmoil within, it makes Afghanistan look like it's an annex to what's going on in Pakistan, and it's unclear even what the relationship is. I think... Well, I'll predict something so that, you know, 2 years from now you can say, you know, boy, he was prescient, or boy, he really was very naive. I don't think Obama is going to go deep militarily into Afghanistan. There will be a lot of pressure to, because there are a lot of people now in sort of deputy assistant secretary levels in the Defense Department in particular who are kind of the leading thinkers in counterinsurgency theory. And I know some of these people, and they're very smart. I mean, there a lot of them are military or retired military. They're in their 30s. They're very smart. They're much smarter than sort of the mainstream generals and senior colonels. And it's tempting, as Kennedy found it tempting in his first 2 years, to pay attention to generals and colonels and captains who are really smart, especially, you know. So there will be a lot of pressure, because there are a lot of ideas that look very good on paper about how you stabilize Afghanistan, for example. But even these people, if you get beyond their executive summaries, and if you have a conversation with them, which he is having, and which Holbrooke is having, and which Secretary Clinton is having, and Gates is having, you know, at the footnote level as well, but, you know, there are a lot of risks. And I, again, partly because we don't have that many troops even taking them all out of – I don't see – if you look at his budget, his budget estimates assume a huge permanent drawdown from Iraq. You look at the numbers, that's where a lot of the savings are coming out of. I don't see him eager to put all of that back into Afghanistan. So from a domestic political view, economic view, it's arguing against it. I think he's also kind of like Kennedy, very interested in maintaining control, very reluctant to get trapped into some escalation, trap, to fall prey to an escalation trap. I don't see him getting in a very, very deep way. And I think you're going to see a lot – the big focus in that region is going to be diplomatic, political, and economic in Pakistan and sort of steady state in Afghanistan, keeping Afghanistan from falling apart more than what it is without much pretense of its becoming, as Gates said in a hearing, some Central Asian Valhalla. I don't think that's in the works, but we'll see.
Sergei Khrushchev, I'm dying to hear your question about the neocon ideas that came a cropper or about Afghanistan or about the mind of Barack Obama.
Or the Russian experience.
His talk, it's very good talk. I will say about Afghanistan, because what is happening now reminding me one by one what happened with the Soviet Union. Because Soviet generals were against invasion in Afghanistan. But then after, when they entered there, each 2 months they said additional division and we will take over. One more. At last, it was finished with 150,000 that could not control Afghanistan at all. Because the biggest mistake, what I think is happening now, that it is this illusion, and your illusion also, that anybody can control Afghanistan. Nobody can control Afghanistan from outside because we're alien. We're alien, they will unite it against us. I remember the good time where we are friends with the king who control Afghanistan. When we talk that Russia will be involved there, I don't think so, because Russia is very happy that United States fighting there because they're scared about influence of Taliban on their Muslims until they're there. And we are not fighting in Afghanistan. We're fighting with Pashtuns, the same Pashtuns here and there. I don't know how it's possible to pull out, but any additional brigade, I don't think that will help. And 2 brigade, and if will all the American smart army that was designed for fighting real army, Soviet army, British army, maybe Chinese army, but not Afghanistan, because you don't know who are they. I know Russians who fought there. They told only one possibility to take over the insurgency there, to destroy the village and kill everybody there.
Right. Well, that was the Soviet approach. I mean, the American approach
is
different.
No, it was not a Soviet approach. It is an approach that all of them against us, no difference who we are, British, Russian, Soviet, or American. And it is big difference with Iraq, because Iraq is organized 3 powers that can be controlled. There you cannot control anything.
Well, when I was in Afghanistan...
Thank you.
When I was in Afghanistan a few years ago, I was visiting the main NATO headquarters. There was power was just being transferred to NATO. And I was talking with a NATO colonel, a British guy, who noted that where we were standing was, in fact, the base that the Soviets had used and the base that the British had used, a century before. And, in fact, over in the corner was a cannon that the British had used. And this NATO guy said, well, third time's the charm, and sort of giggled. But, Afghanistan is... It's not really – you're right. It's not – if you fly over Afghanistan, you see nothing but craggly mountains. And then occasionally there will be kind of a thin blue line. And two very thin green lines on either side of it, and then a craggly mountains again. I mean, it's just valley after valley after valley, and they have a long history of puncturing imperial balloons, and you know, I think the Americans. Soldiers there now, they have some training in counterinsurgency warfare from Iraq. The commanders are much smarter, but, you know, again, my fear is that they're smart, but not as smart as they think they are. You can be too smart for some situations. And, you know, Petraeus, for example, who is a very, you know, smart guy and who has a strategic mind, he has this idea, it worked in certain places in Iraq, that we would find factions of the Taliban that are not so ideologically committed that could be turned. You know, they're nationalists, they're pissed because somebody killed their cousin, that they're not really fanatical diehards. They can be turned to join with us if we can show them that it's worth their while to come with us. But, you know, there's massive histories of this where these guys, they'll turn because you're giving them $10 more a week than the other guys are, and then the next month the other guys will give them $5 more and they'll turn again. I mean, it's nothing that you can hold on to. So it worries me. It worries me quite a bit, and I think it I hope that it also worries Obama. I don't think Obama is the sort of guy who says, okay, I have to put in more brigades and then still more brigades because I just have to do this. You know, I mean, you know, Johnson did this in Vietnam because he didn't want to be the first American president to lose a war because the big threat was the communists. You know, this idea that North Vietnam was, you know, just acting as an agent of the Sino-Soviet menace. I think Obama looks at it from a local and a regional perspective, and it is for that reason that I think he's not really going to get sucked into this. But, you know, things happen.
I was going to respond very quickly to Sergei. I think he's – it's an important remembrance that Afghanistan is the destroyer of empires. But it's funny how people know this from the ground up, but from the top down, we have to relearn it over and over again. When the first Iraq war started, I was flying into Chicago here, and the pilot announced it. And in the taxi ride up to Hyde Park, you know, I was hearing about every bomb hitting its target, just as you recounted, you know, the gloriousness of war was, you know, in that first sort of patriotic rush. And my taxi cab driver didn't say anything. And I just wish Sergei could provide the voice here, because it turns out the guy was Russian, taxi cab driver. And all he said to me was, you know, they told us we would be there 10 months. We were there for 10 years. You know, and that wisdom stuck with me for a very long time of you know, someone who'd been there, done that.
And, you know, Tommy Franks, the CENTCOM commander in Iraq, was telling his troops that the war started in Iraq in March. He thought they would be down to 30,000 troops by September. Yeah. That's September of 2003.
Hmm. Yeah. You know. Hard lessons. So. We have another question.
So America's self-declared role as the sole superpower is short-lived. And I wonder whether there's anything in your book or anything that you've learned recently about whether Obama aspires to capture this title too.
Well, I don't think he captures the title. One thing that I should note is that, one thing that is true is that the United States is the only country in the world that has global reach politically, militarily, and economically. And I think there are a lot of countries that would like to see the United States reassert or resume its leadership role. But in resuming the role of a leader, we have to show that we're worth following. We can't just assert this or much less insist on it. Every country is going down the tubes economically now, but even so, the dollar and the United States are doing better than a lot of other places. And in the G20 and other summits to come, it's going to be, by default, if nothing else, the United States that takes a leadership role. But again, it's going to have to be the kind of leader that arouses and inspires and provides incentives to followers. That's going to be the difference.
Fred, could I take you back to questions about the bad ideas that we've been living through, especially about weaponry, domination of foreign peoples and whatnot? The United States' closest bilateral attachment in the world seems to be to Israel, and we sort of take it for granted that Israel practices a lot of the doctrines and the habits that you're decrying and that we all decry, including unilateral, highly militarized, asymmetrical relations with what it considers to be eternally hostile neighbors. Does that not put us in a kind of intellectual and diplomatic bind as we try to shed those ways in our own relations with the world?
Well, first, in fairness, I mean, at least in its geographical position, Israel can't rely on very many allies. I mean, they're sort of unilateral by necessity.
Right.
They don't team up with Egypt to go do something again. You know, it is what it is. But obviously, you know, I think, you know, during the first Bush president, Bush 41 and Clinton, they had an envoy to the Middle East. There was the same guy. It was Dennis Ross. And one of Dennis Ross's jobs was to – every time somebody – I'm speaking metaphorically here – anytime anybody – lit a match, he was to go blow it out because he knew that these things can spread like wildfire in the Middle East. And, I mean, there were times when Dennis Ross would be at home in his Maryland suburb house on a Saturday and he would get a call and it would be some guy at a checkpoint in the territories and a fistfight had broken out between some guard and a Palestinian and they needed Dennis Ross to kind of negotiate an end to the fist fight. I mean, it came down to that. Now, to some ways, it's like, well, this is almost absurd. But that's how the place didn't blow up for 10 years. Bush 43 comes along and says, we're not going to do this stuff anymore. We're not going to lend the name of a great power to this diddly stuff. And Israel, you should just deal with this the way you want. And that was, you know, that was the worst thing that any American president could have done for Israel's long-term interests. A lot of the war with Hezbollah in August 06, you know, it started out, Hezbollah started it. Israel fights back. Initially, I don't know if people remember this, but the Arab League drew up a statement condemning Hezbollah for its unconscionable premeditated attack. This was an unprecedented sort of thing. Several advisors in the State Department called or sent notes to Condi Rice, who was with Bush in St. Petersburg for a G8 summit, saying, look, this is a strategic opportunity. You've got to get over there. You've got to start doing shuttle diplomacy now. This is an opportunity to create a new strategic reality. We can create some alliances here. And she let it go. And this was that press conference where she said, I don't want to go over there because there's no point going over there just to resume the status quo. She talked about what was the phrase?
The birth pangs of a new Middle East.
The birth pangs of a new Middle East, which was like, oh, wow.
Well,
this I don't want to see. I don't want to see the baby coming out of this birth pangs. So then by the time she was willing to go over and talk, Israel had escalated beyond even columnists in Haaretz were criticizing it as a disproportionate response. They got this notion that they could just destroy Hezbollah through air attacks, when, you know, Hezbollah was integrated into the society, it just couldn't be done. And by that time, the Saudis retracted their position from the Arab summit, Arab League statements. So that's it. I mean, very rarely do you have a strategic opportunity. The basic law of diplomacy in the Middle East is stay there, stay there, stay there, keep talking, even if it's useless. I mean, the United States gained a lot of cred in the Middle East by continuing the Israeli-Palestinian talks all through the years when Arafat was in power, and therefore any kind of settlement was probably impossible, but still it looked like we were giving it a shot. So you stay there so that when there is an opportunity for a strategic breakthrough, you can pounce on it right away. And there were a couple of these opportunities during the Bush administration, and they were squandered.
Fred Kaplan, I have one last question about the mind of Barack Obama.
Ah, well.
He's a pragmatic politician, as you say. He's also a master of, has to be, of a huge amount of budgetary detail. But at the same time, I think it's, this is my guess, but it's in his DNA to see the world in a big picture frame, too, that's enormously different. And in short, he's been handed an empire in crisis, and big crisis. The weapons don't work. The weapons are brilliant beyond imagining, but they don't achieve any of our political objectives anywhere. We've got a disaster in Iraq and a caution in Afghanistan, but we've got crises all over the place. Meantime, our banking system has collapsed. We know we have an infrastructure crisis, a health crisis, an education crisis, and how in the world are we going to pay for it? It seems to me that's the bind that we all know intuitively, and he knows he's in. If, indeed, he does think beyond the details and think of it in roughly that frame, which you outline in your book, what in the world can he, will he, should he do about it?
But, I mean, well...
I mean, say he read your book and said, Fred, you hit the nail on the head. Now what?
Well, I don't know. I think that's what I was raising about the issues of he wants to do all the right things, but you've hit the exact problem. He could do everything exactly right. He could make the right choices, the right decisions, the right mix of force and diplomacy and all that, but it might not amount to much because we just don't control the world in the same way that we did a couple of decades ago. There are other countries that have veto power. They have a vote. They have a vote in what they do. I remember a couple of years ago when Les Gelb and Joe Biden put forth this plan of splitting Iraq into this loose federation of three regions, and they had a very elaborate plan for it. And my reaction to that was, well, okay, look, I'm not even going to deal with the merits of this. The fact is that the Iraqis don't want this, and that's all that matters here.
And they're going to be there.
There's nothing we can do to make them. Even if this were a great idea, and I had my qualms about it, it doesn't matter. Because, I could come here and say, here's, well, Brown University should divide itself. I think you should teach physics this way. I think you should do this. So what? I mean, it might be great ideas, but so what? I'm not the guy making the decision here. And maybe my quislings within aren't the ones either. So that's the problem he's going. How do you – I mean, he starts out at least with good favor. I mean, all over the world – people are saying, well, Jesus, if the United States could elect this guy to be president, maybe we've misunderstood something about this country. Maybe something's going on there that we haven't quite grasped. So he's got he starts out with some favor. He's with a presumption of maybe something will change. I figure he's got about 9 months to make good on this, to show that he's actually doing something different in fact. And the degree to which he succeeds at doing this, unfortunately, depends on a lot more than just him. It depends on the Iraqis, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Chinese, the Russians. And these aren't even at least with the Cold War, you could go here and you could make a deal here and it would affect, to some degree, the entire system of things. That's not true anymore. There is no one power that we could make a deal with where we could ensure that the two of us could ensure that it's going to work out the way. It's like Congress. When Lyndon Johnson was president, he actually, you know, went, he got in the leaders of a couple of committees, Senate committees. He put them in a room and he said, I'm locking the door. Don't come out until you've written an education bill. Okay, he could do that then, partly because he was Lyndon Johnson, but partly the structure of the Senate was such that you could do that. Barack Obama could not do that now. No president could do that now. It's a similar thing written much, much larger is true in the world. Two powers, we can't get together with Putin or who or whoever and figure out what's going to happen to the rest of the world. That's the tragedy of being a large power in the world, in the post-Cold War world. It's still post-Cold War. We don't know what it is or even what pre-world it is, and we won't find out for a while.
Fred Kaplan, come back in 9 months and tell us what these birth pangs have produced,
right.
Will you?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks much.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.